Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Business Brew. I am your host, Bill Brewster. This episode features Mario Sabelli. Mario Sabelli is managing partner and chief investment officer of Marathon Partners Equity Management. Mario is somebody that I met at Markel last year and was able to put a face to a Twitter handle. And since then, I have spoken with him on and off. One of the true joys of this show is getting to know the guests, and Mario is no exception to the rule. I have heard nothing but good things about him as a mentor and as a person, and I have found those things to be true as I've gotten to know him, and I hope that I did a good job interviewing him. I hope you enjoy the conversation. I'd like to give a shout out to Stratosphere.io for sponsoring the show over the past few episodes. My side of the obligation is fulfilled. But that is a product, as with all the products that have sponsored this show, I don't take a sponsor unless I like what they do. And I appreciate Braden and his team, what they've built, and I appreciate them sponsoring the show. So thank you to them. You can find them at stratosphere.io. That's stratosphere.io. As you know, I've used their stuff. I like their stuff. You can check it out for free should you want to sign up for the additional stuff, whether it's KPIs or more financial data. Use the promo code BREW for 15% off. As for disclosures, Marathon Partners Equity Management may own positions in the companies discussed. Past performance is not indicative of future results. Investing involves risks, including the loss of capital. And as always, none of this is financial advice. All of the information contained in this program is for entertainment purposes only. Please consult your financial advisor before making investment decisions and do your own due diligence. All right, enjoy the show. All right, ladies and gentlemen, thrilled to be joined by Mario Sabelli today. Thank you very much. It was nice. We first met in person at Markel last year. That was nice. Are you attending this year?
I'm not sure. You know, maybe.
Yeah.
I remember we met on the rooftop. It was a wonderful evening.
It was a nice evening. Thank you. Likewise. Same feeling.
On the roof of Richmond, it was a wonderful evening.
Yeah. Well, you've got a hookup at Rabati should you need one, right? So I think you can get a ticket.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Speaking of Bob, you once said to me that you learned a lot from Bob. So you want to talk a little bit about your background and kind of where you formed sort of a younger Mario and then how you became who you are today?
Yeah, sure. You know, I graduated in 1990 from Binghamton. So I'm a state school boy trying to make it in the big leagues in New York City with all these hedge fund managers. And my first job was with Mario Gabelli, still around. So I'd say Mario and Bob were my two biggest influences. So, I worked for Gabelli straight out of college. That was great. And back then, you know, he was untouchable. He was like the king. You know, everything he touched went to gold. It was unbelievable. He did a lot of, you know, he's a value guy, but he did cable companies. He bought, you know, things that were losing money, but were accreting value through other methods and media businesses and properties. So that was a great place to kind of see some things in action. And Bob Rabati worked there for a while, so I met Bob through someone that worked at with Gabelli, and I did a 2-year stint in between at investment bank, and then, you know, that wasn't for me, and I went straight to Bob Rabati, and, you know, and Bob had a very different view. He did a lot of small caps, micro caps, called pink sheets back in the day. He did a lot of energy, insurance companies, all sorts of different things, very different than Mario. So I kind of had the two of them as probably my biggest influences. You know, I did a lot of reading, and I guess another big influence was, you know, the way I made my living early on was selling research to hedge fund managers. You know, a lot of guys that run big funds now, like, you know, I don't know, Dan Loeb and Ricky Sandler and other guys. I learned a tremendous amount trying to sell research to very smart people in the late to mid 90s. I probably learned as much from them as anyone, as both from Bob and Mario, just because some of them were very difficult to deal with and asked, you know, terribly complex questions, and I'd run around and try to figure everything out. So I learned a lot from selling research as well.
So what was that Was that at Gabelli?
Oh, that was when I was at Robotti and Company. Yeah, when I went to Bob, you know, I sold research to institutional investors, you know, to kind of make a living. And then from there, I did manage some money in separate accounts and started, you know, getting my sea legs in that whole business. And then I started a fund in 1997. And in fact, yes, let's say April 4th, I started that fund on April Fool's Day in 1997. So we hit 26 years this weekend.
There you go. Well, happy anniversary.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah. My buddy Kevin sold research for Gabelli, and it was always an interesting, I always enjoyed talking to him about his job. It sounds like you really got to be prepared when you're going to sell a piece of research. Right. I mean,
I sold Bob's research at first, then I started selling my own, and I tended to do pretty well in these niches of inefficiencies, spinoffs and rights offerings, recaps, post bankruptcies, all sorts of unusual things, and small cap companies as well. And, you know, there tends to be more overt inefficiencies in some of those sectors. And it's a good place to kind of learn. And, you know, I did plenty of that. So when I was selling research to all these big time money managers, you know, that was one area that I tended to do pretty well in.
Yeah. So you started in 97 and were you primarily small cap focused at the time?
You know, to this day, you know, we're not kind of small cap focused. We're all cap. So over time, you know, we varied the median market cap in the portfolio probably by a pretty decent amount. But initially, when I first started the fund, you know, I did do a lot in small caps, but not only that, I did a lot of inefficient sectors, and you know, a lot of those were smaller companies, but not all of them were. And you know, part of the reason for that is the opportunity set at the time back then was pretty was high. You know, and there was this one year which hasn't quite happened ever again. It was 1998, this very difficult, bizarre year where the S&P 500 was up over 20% and the Russell was down about 9%. So smalls got smoked, but big caps went up a lot. And, you know, that doesn't completely rhyme with what's been going on today, but that kind of long stretch of underperformance by smalls is with us again. And I do think the current market now is as close to the early 2000s as I've seen, even more interesting than post GFC back in 08, 09. There's just so many things to look at right now. I've been working flat out. I haven't had a day off in a long time. There's so many things to go through right now. And so it's kind of an exciting time to be looking and putting value out, though we did have to, you know, get our butt kicked. We do growth and value names, but, you know, like summer of 21 to the summer of 22 was, you know, one of the worst stretches, you know, that I've had in 25 years of running our fund. We've done well since then. For the past 9 months, we've beaten the market and kind of got back some of our underperformance. But I think the opportunity set right now is as interesting as it's been in over 20 years.
Well, one of the reasons that I asked you if you focused on small in the beginning was, if you did, it must have been a wild thing to come out of the gate in a time when, you know, when big just kind of exploded to the upside. And then I have been trying to talk to people that were around in 2000 about what that was like, because it does come up a decent amount among the veterans that today sort of rhymes with 2000. And you were the first person that pinged me and said, look, I think small is a really, really interesting set right now. So I'm kind of curious to hear, I mean, you've been through a number of cycles. Why does today remind you of that time? And why is today so exciting in the SMID area?
Yeah, so I just think the sheer number of companies that appear interesting to look at, either, you know, their share price is down significantly, the valuation, it screens low, the valuation is low, recent, even like some companies in March with no news on the small side were down massively. They're just signs that there's so many things to look at, and there's usually not that many things to look at. So that parallels, that rhymes to me back then. And then the perceived safety, you know, people I believe are overpaying for safety right now on the equity side. And I think that's pretty obvious. So I think you can't look in the rearview mirror to kind of figure out what's going to work prospectively going forward. You know, and what's worked over the past decade post GFC generally has been, you know, a passive strategy, a fully invested strategy, a strategy that's focused even, you know, on the 50 biggest companies or even 5 biggest companies. That's worked really, really well. I think it's unlikely to work well again over the next 5 to 10 years. I mean, I have to put such low odds on that. So I guess part of what's interesting and this whole thing recently with the banks, potential bank runs in a very different way than the great financial crisis, it's put pressure on the small caps again, because some of the indices that investors use to get exposure to small caps have much bigger exposure to banks and financial institutions. Mm. Those things are being redeemed, and then they're redeeming all these other kind of non-financial companies alongside of that. So you actually had a pressure-filled March for a lot of small companies, and they were already interesting to begin with. And so like that, those additional redemptions, I think to get away from financial exposure has just kept the pressure on. So I think the valuations on some of these small companies, not think, I know, some of them are so low that it's just going to invite activists, strategic investors, private equity. It's going to invite transactions to begin occurring. And you've seen a number of deals already. You'll see more of them. I think the absolute number of deals will go up, but the deal size will be much lower. So the total dollar of the deals, this happened in the 2000s, won't be that impressive, but the number of deals and the deals concentrated on smaller companies will go up dramatically. So I've seen this movie before. I'm convinced that I know the ending here. So maybe that's a little bit dangerous. I can't tell you starting when these things are going to rip, but I feel on the small microcap, small and mids, it's inevitable what's going to happen. They're going to outperform. That doesn't mean, you know, Apple, you don't have to sell all your Apple shares to kind of fund buys of some of these other smaller companies, but maybe you're going to sell 6 or 7% of your Apple shares, because there's only a handful of companies at the very tippity top that whose value exceeds the entire Russell 2000.
Yeah. So, okay. If I think it's interesting that you brought up private equity, because you and I were involved in a Twitter back and forth just a couple of weeks ago. Why hasn't private equity already picked over these businesses, right? Like, why does this opportunity still exist today when there's been so much dry powder in private equity? And why aren't all the great businesses already gobbled up?
Well, because all the smart guys go to private equity, right? There's no smart guys that invest in public markets kind of thing, or like the private equity guys, they take all the good apples. And so when you and I come around shopping,
yes, no, we're left with the bad apples, I think is the argument.
There's that, I don't know, that almost is like the air I breathe. I don't see the air, but you know, I know it's there. I can't imagine that's true. They get some good companies. It's a pain in the ass to buy a public company. You got to convince the board to sell. Companies don't always want to do that. You know, there's too many of them out there. They don't get to all of them at once. The concept that every good company is owned by private equity or anything that they passed on is a bad company, I actually shouldn't even respond to that. Who asked that question?
I don't know. I'm not going to name names, but yeah, I mean, you know, it's been something that I have contemplated in the past. So that's why I was intrigued by the dialogue. But one company that came up was Carter's, and that is a business that I sent a lot of money to over the past, not so recently, but for, I guess, 5 years of my life. I was buying their clothes like crazy and my kids were destroying them. So it's a company that I understand well, And I can understand why at the valuation that it traded at, it was not taken out. And it's trading at a lot lower valuation today than it has been in the past. So it's I can understand your point. And there's good apples that have fallen down to interesting spots.
It's always the other sector. It's always the other guy where that's the smart money. Like I always get cracked up when they're like, the treasury market is signaling a recession, you know, and sometimes it does, and sometimes it gets things right. But it's like, it's not like there's one set of investors in this other asset class that kind of has perfect information. You know, their side, whatever they're investing in is competitive too, and everyone's trying to get an edge on everyone else. So, you know, to me, the idea that private equity is what public market investors are feeding on is the leftovers that the private equity didn't want. To me, there's nothing further than the truth. Carter's has been LBO'd, by the way. You know, a lot of companies that are out there have been LBO'd in the past. I think it was quite some time since it was bought out, but it has the characteristics that might lead it to be an attractive candidate again as leverage comes down. But you do have different tolerances for leverage in the public markets versus the private markets. The private markets, I guess, arguably with full control, you know, might have a bit more room for additional leverage versus public market investors who have to band together at times if they want to have a regime change or something different. So that probably makes some sense. Anyway, yeah, I like Carter's. This Carter's is one that I mentioned to you and one that you know, I think is kind of falls into this mid-cap undervalued territory. They just spit out cash, mad cash. And have done so for so long, and they own some great brands, and they sell direct to consumer, they sell wholesale, and you know, listen to the CEO speak, and I would bet you there's no one in the world that knows children's and babies' clothing apparel better than him. And to me, it's really simple. It's a simple business. It's not that complicated, and they seem like really stand up folks there. My instinct is that it is closer to a consumer staple than an apparel company. So it trades in apparel multiple. You're going to buy the clothes. The baby needs to be wearing something. And certainly their customers get pinched by inflation like everyone else. You know, but there's a limit to how much you can cut back in that space. And, you know, and they're not premium priced. They get some premium over private label. But of course, if you really want to buy your baby's fancy clothing, you're probably reaching for some other brand. So, you know, that's indicative of the kind of things that are trading in this market. You know, I look at what can these guys earn in 2025? Maybe $7.50 in earnings per share. I don't think that's too aggressive. You know, would the market pay 13.5 times for that in late 24 or early 25? Plus $13 of retained earnings between now and then. You know, you get yourself 115, 120 pretty easily on a current share price. And that's not without a lot of leverage. So there's stuff like that everywhere. Stuff like that is everywhere. I tweeted 2 weeks ago, cheap small cap stocks are a dime a dozen. They're just all over the place.
Well, with something like Carter's, and this is an interesting point that you make. So when you have so much choice between cheap small cap stocks, are you looking for? And I don't think there's going to be a specific answer here, but how do you think through looking for a business that maybe should be sold and you could go activist, or something like Carter's that you view as a staple? And I tend to agree. I think it's a great value proposition for parents that, you know, you can maybe own for the long term should the market not pay you a 13 times multiple in 5 years, right? And how are you thinking about the opportunity cost of maybe buying more special situation type businesses versus looking for something that can grow and compound for a while?
Yeah, it's a good question. I've always tried to maintain a balance, and I think, look, you know, I made some errors in late 2020, early 2021, hanging on to some disruptive growth companies kind of at valuations that didn't make sense. A lot of people made mistakes. A lot of companies, now we're starting to unwind some of this. There was a sea change going on, and you know, company after company overinvested in meeting the demand from a changed world during the, you know, coronavirus pandemic. And a lot of that's being unwound now. You see PayPal unwinding, other companies unwinding, taking costs out, all that. So, you know, I did kind of make some mistakes and that's that. But balancing between long-term kind of investment potential and other names that potentially should be part of consolidation or should go private or no longer, you know, the public markets are no longer a good home for those companies. You know, there's a balance there. We have some names in the portfolio that I think really probably shouldn't be independent publicly traded companies. And it, you know, look, trajectory matters. If they're doing good things, if they're watching over their P&L closely and they're cutting costs and they're doing reasonable things while driving their business forward closer to profitability or starting to scale to profitability, you know, that matters versus another team that maybe really will have a very difficult time in justifying life as an independent publicly traded company over time. So, you know, we would tend to put a premium right now on situations where there is some opportunity for shareholder returns, pull forward of shareholder returns or value creation somewhat in the immediacy.
What kind of company isn't ripe to be a public company? I hear this a decent amount, and I have now started to experience it, but I don't know that I know a good answer for this. It seems as though the knock against the public markets are that they don't allow companies to turn around different divisions or they're not patient. And then on the other hand, I see certain businesses that execute a lot get a ton of leash from the public markets, and investors do seem really long-term focused. So what is the type of company that doesn't really work well as a public company?
Well, you know, one that strikes me, and look, there's a spectrum. There's kind of absolutely shouldn't be public towards could go either way towards, you know, I think this company over time, they could make it. You know, I like a lot is Eventbrite. I like the founders there. We've owned that one for a while. And I think they have a great product. It's growing. It does seem over time that it will be difficult for that company to make enough money to drive enough return for its shareholders versus maybe a strategic owner.
Okay.
That being said, the trajectory that they have is very good right now. They raise prices, they're cutting costs, they're offshoring some costs, and you know, it looks like they're gonna make it to the other side. But I do think longer term, you know, look, it costs 10 to 15 million to be a public company easy, and a smaller company, that's, you know, that's could be a pretty big swing value. So I think on something like that ultimately that probably the best place to be for a company like that is a strategic owner, you know, that could sell more to its customers, or there's some leverage in the model where, you know, some of those public company costs and other costs can kind of go out. It's a very interesting niche that they serve. They're essentially like the Ticketmaster for small event organizers. They call them creators. And I don't put that one on the spectrum of absolutely positively shouldn't be public. But I do think like over time that one may be best served by not being a independent publicly traded company. And I think that management team will probably figure that out. You know, on the other side, I'll show you something. Sorry, break some rules.
Oh, it's all good.
I love these shoes. They're old Burt's.
Yeah.
And I've loved that product for about 6 or 7 years. And on that one, and we've talked to them, and you know, we've shared some thoughts. I'm very hard pressed to see how Allbirds could justify being an independent, publicly traded company. It kind of doesn't make sense. The shares have been, you know, absolutely decimated. They're probably trading at negative enterprise value right now, which can make sense in a small. It's went from billions and billions of market cap to like a negative enterprise value, and they're losing money. I think they have a great product. I love it. And you don't have to wear socks with the Allbirds. There's a lot of really nice things about them. A very comfortable shoe. I don't think they're the best looking shoe, but they're very comfortable and they sell pretty nicely to a certain demographic, tend to be a little bit older. But on something like that, you know, I think that company is going to have a very hard time remaining an independent publicly traded company. I won't say it's impossible. They kind of make it to the other side. They certainly could. But a lot of these companies, you have to realize, you know, they came out and grabbed these big valuations, you know, and they're told to grow at all costs. And that's kind of being unwound at some of these companies, including Allbirds. And, you know, they just got off on the wrong foot. And, you know, then they're behind the eight ball trying to figure out, like, where do I cut costs? What do I do? Everything like that. And, you know, look, if you're on the board of some of these companies and you're a fiduciary, you got to think really hard and think creatively about what makes the most sense for shareholders here. And I do think those are just two. There's so many companies that shouldn't be public. And when you get into the SPACs, which I tend not to even traffic in, like then it's even crazier. So I do think almost for sure, you know, essentially the market cap of all these things have come crashing down and they've gone upside down. You know, many of them are their intrinsic value now well exceeds their market cap. And that's just going to do the opposite of what happened from 2020 and 2021. The market was paying more intrinsic value. They all come public. Now the market's paying less in intrinsic value. Guess what? There's no IPOs. There's no SPACs going on. And the ones that exist, they're going to start going away. It's going to be like a drain. You know, someone's opening up a hole underneath the tub and there's going to be fewer and fewer of them until the cycle turns. So, you know, those are just two examples. And again, I like the teams at both of these companies, but, you know, it's not a time for playing around. Like, hard decisions have to be met. And it's not like, yeah, small caps are cheap, but it's not like the macro backdrop's awesome, man. It's scary right now. Yeah. Lots of things could happen. So, you know, I think I said this to Elliot Turner once on a podcast, which is like, you know, you've been dropped off at sea. The boat forgot you. You know, you're left there. You can see the shore. It's at night. Those are the lights. There's no rescue boat coming. If you can't swim to shore, you're dead. Like all these companies are going to have to sort through this stuff. And so that creates amazing opportunities. Absolutely, you know, amazing opportunities to kind of help these companies bridge the gap between, hey, you're stuck in as a public company. You got a good product. Things are working. Maybe you got a convertible that you're going to have to refi or something like that. Maybe you should refi it and stick with it, or maybe not. Maybe there's a strategic here that will pay you a hefty premium. And by the way, you've seen some non-standard premiums recently, like 30% premium, all that kind of stuff. That's out the door. Like some of these things are so cheap, you have to pay closer to intrinsic value, which, you know, makes it super interesting if you can own some of these equities. But these things have to get sorted out. And I'm convinced, like, so I've seen this movie before. It's going to take 8 to 9 quarters. When it turns, it's going to turn fast. And then the relative best performers will be small and mid-cap managers. The money will find them. There'll be passive ways to invest in these managers, but passive won't be the only way to do it. Some of these deals that are happening are for non-index companies. So managers that own them, you know, are outside of the index. There will be no index to get at these managers. So when that happens, you know, eventually the fund flows will come that way, and you know, the whole cycle will reverse, and smalls will become overvalued again, and IPOs will happen, and other things will happen. So the supply will increase. That's not where we are today, though. So I mean, I don't want to sound too confident predicting the future, but I've seen this movie before. I'm convinced of this. So we still have some big caps in the portfolio, but the thing that we're looking at, the median thing we're looking at right now, is a smaller company that's been beat up and left for dead.
Are you skewing US or foreign, or does it not really matter? It seems like something that comes up in some of my discussions are specifically London listed small. Sometimes Australia comes up too.
We have Western European, UK, US businesses. We have a Mexican business that we like a lot, Beckley. But we can look all around the world. You know, we tend to probably stick to Western Europe and US, you know, mostly. the one in the UK that we like. Well, there's two in the UK that we like. One is Fever Tree, and the other one's Doc Martens. And Doc Martens is kind of a perfect specimen example of a orphaned IPO. Great company, great brand. Came public, I think, at 380 pence. It's probably 140 pence now. It probably topped out post IPO at 450 or 500.
Yeah, pence. That's what I thought I saw.
Absolutely murdered. And it's a great brand. It's been around since a little bit after World War II. It's not new, but that one, you know, sticks out like a sore thumb versus its peers and comps on valuation.
I was surprised to see how good the EBITDA margins are in that business.
Yeah, they're quite
like
good.
Like 28, 29, something like that. Don't quote me, folks. Go do your own work. But I think that's where they are, which is pretty solid.
Yeah, they're very solid. They've been under private equity ownership and control, and private equity is pretty good at getting margins higher. So, you know, maybe someone could say, hey, this opportunity is available to you, Mario, because, you know, private equity already squeezed out everything there was to be squeezed out. You know, there could be some truth to that. One of the fears is if you kind of go back. With a lot of companies you know that benefited, perceived to be COVID beneficiaries, you go back to what was 2018, what was 2019 like, and a 2018, 2019 profits wouldn't necessarily support in a great way the current share price of this company. So you have that to worry about a bit. But the thing that I really, really adore about them is that they had a period going back in the 90s when they owned manufacturing capacity and they had a different view of the world, which is let's keep those factories busy, and they got over inventoried and they had to come down on pricing and gross margins got hit. And, you know, it was an absolute shit show for a period of time. So I think that experience is still with them. And they are very, very keen to keep margins. And as long as they keep margins, if revenues are up a little bit, revenues are down some, but they're very focused on their margins and they're not trying to meet some arbitrary kind of top line growth number, they'll do fine. And part of their growth, by the way, they have grown a lot since 2019, but a significant chunk of that was the move to DTC from wholesale. They still have wholesale, but they have a lot of stores. They do a lot online.
Yeah, they said their margins are like four times better, right? DTC. Yeah. I thought that's what they said.
Yeah, something like that. But essentially, their revenues are up more than the pairs of shoes, boots that they've sold, and that one just strikes me as a perfect little orphan. That it's too good of a brand. It's been around for far too long to kind of just be sitting. You know, quoted as a public company sitting out in London and now at somewhat depressed price. Private equity still has a fairly significant stake in it. So that has to be sorted out. We'll see what happens there. But unless earnings were, you know, about to fall off a cliff, the shares look very, very cheaply priced. In fact, I guess the market's already saying that their earnings aren't going to be as high as you think, that they're going to be down significantly. And, maybe they won't be. We'll see. So, yeah, it's just this tons of stuff like that floating all around. You know, that's I think that IPO probably in 21.
Yeah, 2021 is what I thought I saw. I am a sucker for management teams that own mistakes. I wish that I had more skepticism, but when they opened up their last earnings call and they said, like, look, these are self-inflicted wounds. I tend to enjoy when people own the mistakes, because I can understand a mistake. I mean, I don't think it's a fair thing to ask people to be perfect. I do think it's a fair thing to ask people to own up to mistakes when they make them and to communicate what happened and what they're doing to change it. So it'll be interesting to see. I thought that that was a very candid earnings call. So we'll see. As I said, the only thing that makes me a little nervous is being so tied to that one shoe style. But as you said, it's very iconic.
Yeah, it's and look, I can't even say I'm not an expert of the company. We have like a 1% position on it, and we're doing more work. It's not like they're, again, it's not the most complicated business. They make boots in Asia, and they float them over to the U.S. and other places and sell them. Good brand. They do a good job of that. It is interesting. I think it's well over half of their business doesn't, it's the same boot year in, year out, the exact same thing, doesn't change. So there's no kind of fashion risk on that. And it's sort of like, it's even crazier. 80% of what they sell is the color black.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny. So that one is, it's interesting. Oh, I was going to say that they have one shoe. I think that's like 40% of their business. It's called, I think it's called the 4160 because they first produced it on April 1st, 1960. So when you have that lack of fashion, I guess, is a fashion. It can go out of style, and it's tended to, you know, go in some waves. You know, the lack of fashion. So to some extent, that you'd say, oh, there's no fashion risk, but you know, the lack of fashion kind of goes in and out of fashion. So I think they're coming off a pretty good run, but I also think they've kind of crossed the chasm to it's a legitimate brand that's going to have a high base level of sales kind of from here on in. The exact growth rate, you know, we don't need a lot of growth from here as long as they preserve their margins to do all right. But, you know, look, Crocs, I you would have picked Crocs as potentially is more of a fad, and
they're everywhere.
The fad's going pretty strong.
Yes, so, it is.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Listen, this is one product. I do not own a pair of Doc Martens. I've threatened to. I feel like I have to at this point get a pair and wear them around. It's kind of not my brand, but maybe I'll buy one next week.
I don't know that you need to own a pair of everything that you have in the portfolio, but so you mentioned margins twice. Have you had experience in your career that has? This is ringing true because I just listened to Gary Friedman on Restoration Hardware's call talk about margins and how he's going to be disciplined on margins. Is that a tell when a management team is really focused on margins and not willing to get promotional to drive volumes, that they're focused on the right thing, or am I taking something a little bit too blankety, like away from?
No, I think they're really saying, I want to preserve the integrity of the brand. I don't want to overstock it. I don't want people to, you know, think that it's a commodity. So I think that's a good indication of that. I was going to tell you something funny. We'll see if it's funny. You kind of said, oh, you don't need to wear the boots to own the shares. We owned a prison operator many years ago. I was in Houston.
Did you go to prison?
No, we did management team, and I remember I was like, this is one company where I do not need to kind of like get intimately familiar with the end product, the service.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I'm not really willing to do the scuttlebutt on this one that I need to.
Yeah, it ended up going private, so it was a good investment.
So a little different than your Netflix research, right?
Absolutely different. Yeah, no counting numbers on envelopes there. Counting prisoner numbers. How many prisoners are in there? How much are we getting paid per prisoner? No, thank you.
Yeah, that's right. Do you mind telling that story real quick for anybody that didn't hear your Invest Like the Best podcast, which they should listen to? But that's a cool story, how you cracked the Netflix code, for lack of a better term, on how much volume they were shipping.
Oh, sure. Yeah, no, it was kind of interesting. I over the years, I'd learned some tricks and still know some tricks. I haven't revealed every trick of the trade. But, you know, there's a lot of people that do lots of different things to get data. You know, you can subscribe to credit card panels and stuff, but everyone does that. So, I don't know. We try to play heads up ball. And we played a heads up ball, you know, with Netflix. You know, we subscribe to we own shares of Netflix. We had a good relationship with Reed Hastings. But the way we kind of made the relationship a really to a nice relationship, two-way street with them, is that we noticed, I think we noticed it first on Blockbuster videos envelopes for their DVDs. There was all sorts of numbers on them. And I'm like, you know, what are the patterns of these numbers? Why is this number always changing? And this number isn't changing. We kind of did some work and realized that, you know, on Blockbuster's envelope, they were telling you, you know, unique individual customer numbers and DVDs. And then we were like, oh, what did the Netflix envelope show? And they didn't show the customer ID, but they showed a sequential kind of serial number for DVDs. So, you know, we were able to track Blockbuster, seeing that they had massive off the charts churn. And we wanted to share that with Netflix, but when we thought when we shared that with Netflix, of course, they'll realize that their envelopes are allowing us to track them. But they're such good people and such smart people that we essentially traded away that advantage. And those advantages get traded away and arbitraged out anyway for a better relationship with that team. It kind of became a little bit of a legendary story. And I think he's still on the board. You know, I'm friendly with Rich Barton, really smart guy, really successful guy. And, you know, I ran into him once many, many years ago, and I was telling him, hey, you know, I told him the story. I'm like, you know, I did this thing with Netflix. And he's like, that was you? Kind of how it made it to the board level that someone in New York had figured out that Blockbuster was, that their online service was, you know, headed towards a brick wall, and they were going at 100 miles per hour. And, you know, so I think it helped the company out at a time when they intuitively from the outside, you could probably say that Blockbuster's total access DVD subscription plan was unsustainable, but we kind of had the data to back it up, and we gladly traded it to them to enhance the relationship and help them. And it was kind of funny. It was a moment in time.
Yeah, that's cool. How do you go about developing relationships? I mean, not to divulge all your secrets, but Elliot has talked to me about how you've mentored him in engaging management teams and being thoughtful about that. You know, if you could impart some words of wisdom on younger analysts or somebody that's looking to, I don't know, add value to a management team in order to gain some access, or just, I don't know how I want to say it, but that's kind of the first thing that came to mind. Like, what would you say to do?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think some of these stuff for me personally evolved over time. You know, my wife has told me if I wasn't an investor, I'd be a therapist. So I do really value getting to meet management teams face to face. I like visiting them where they reside, where they're comfortable, not, you know, in New York at a conference or something like that, where there's 25 different hedge funds asking them all the same questions about modeling and whatnot. And, you know, I don't know, like even, I guess I'm thinking like, I'm going off the top of my head here a little bit, but, you know, like Warren Buffett, I've always believed, you know, I'm not buying a certificate, I'm buying a business. So if you're buying a business, how does that business tick? What makes it work? And I just love talking about businesses. It's like a hobby, almost like baseball cards or something like that. It's just, you know, what makes this business tick? What's real? You know, like what dynamics are interesting? How did this develop? What's the history here? All that kind of stuff. And, you know, I think if you're good at interpreting things like that, you know, I have helped teams from time to time, you know, over the years. I don't know, to me, it's like a natural thing. If you like tinkering with things and someone gives you the story of how something developed or something, why, you know, is why the way it is, someone from the outside that's not sitting there every day and the CEO is not his or her boss, could have a different perspective that no one else had. I had a CEO tell me that once. He was like, you know, I like you because you kind of give these non-standard ideas. Everyone in the firm says, you know, I kind of set the directive and they kind of run in that direction, but you don't hear that. So you come in with some wild idea that hasn't been kind of influenced by me. This was a guy that ran an e-com business many years ago. And it was kind of interesting he said that to me. And I came up with a really good idea for that company. And it's just, I don't know, to me, it's a natural thing. I think I'm investing in, you know, real life businesses, not pieces of paper. And I like to know the people I'm investing with and what they're like. I've seen individuals do absolutely crazy, amazing things over time, create so much value with, you know, running something differently or taking a different view on things like that. To me, that's just a fascinating part of the business. I don't like the stocks blinking different prices at me like every day. That's way less interesting to me.
Yeah.
Maybe I should have been a private equity guy. That's where all the smart guys go, right?
I didn't say it. I just said that I thought they looked at a lot of small stuff. That's
some
my only comment.
Account on Twitter. Some anonymous account on Twitter. Let me guess. He works at a private equity firm.
Well, I think that's funny. They got in your head a little bit, I guess.
I'm just trying to be interesting.
No, I know. I think you don't have to try to be interesting. I think you're very interesting to talk to. How have you... So if you are interested in those kind of conversations, do you find that management teams want to talk to you more than the average? Like, what is the average analyst, do you think, calling these people to talk about? Because I have found that when I've hung out with some people that I would assume are getting ask business questions, one of the comments that comes back to me is like, you really want to talk about the business. And I'm shocked that that's a comment. I'm like, well, isn't that what people do with you? And it seems like maybe not always.
Yeah. You know, if you show up and you whip open your laptop and you're adjusting the model as you're talking to the team, you know, that sends a certain kind of message to the team. I've had some management teams tell me, and you know, not all, these are not all small companies. You know, another one from a decent sized company is like, I like talking to you. You definitely have a different perspective on things, and you push me harder on some of these things than other people. So I don't know. I think some of it comes down to your personality. Some of it comes down to what you're interested in. I'm the opposite of an arrogant person. I think there's so many ways to skin the cat. And investing in Wall Street. And I have certain things that I think I'm particularly good at. And there's other things that I'm not good at all. So you have to find a style that works for you. I like visiting companies in the physical world and asking them real questions. And I guess to some extent, I'm just, you know, I haven't rehearsed for this, but I do like tinkering with things. Like, what's the answer here? Is there a better way to do it? What's, you know, my kids always joke that I'm slightly OCD. I don't like waste. I'm always trying to think of ways to save time or do something. If I can find a way to save like 5 seconds a day, like, oh, make this one little change. I just created 5 extra seconds per day for myself. Yeah, that makes me very happy. So I don't know. I do tinker with things. It's a natural way that my mind works. Did I answer that question or not?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think the answer is being genuinely curious and then having a conversation that's authentic to who you are is kind of what I hear out of it. And you happen to have a mind that enjoys thinking about people's businesses and they enjoy talking to you about it. And that's how it happens.
I think that's fair. And, you know, look, I do have some people that are pretty successful people that, you know, that would vouch for me as someone that could add value in a conversation and could be helpful. Look, some of these companies that are public that should be private, they need someone to, you know, they're kind of in this transition, you know, where they're kind of in a bad place. They were in a good place. They came public, you know, everyone was excited. They rang the bell, blah, 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 big valuation, stock-based comp out the wazoo. Everyone's happy, blah, blah, blah. Now you're in a completely different world. Well, this isn't you're in that no man's land. It's a hostile territory. You need to figure out, you know, where you're going to go. And I do think if you're into smash and grab activism and, you know, you want immediate results all the time, whenever you show up, that's one thing. But, you know, if you could, you could make a case for, like, you know, you might be better off as a private company. Here's why. Or I think you could remain public, but here's what you got to do. And it's not a great deal for me. Like, look, it's a form of distress. If a company is losing money and diluting you 3 or 4% a year, and they're not scaling rapidly towards profitability, that's distress. That's distress like having too much debt. You dilute a team, you know, even at a declining rate, dilute the shareholders starting at 3.5% a year, 10 years later at a declining rate, and guess how much of the company you own? You own way less than that company did before. How is that not a form of distress? So there needs to be shareholders and people and others and advisors that help companies get out of this danger zone. And there's a ton of them in this zone right now. I told you, I'm not sure if you caught that term. I said scavenger hunter. I said feel a little bit like a scavenger hunter right now. I mean, scavenger hunter is looking through dead bodies for something of value. And there's a lot of dead bodies out there right now, and they need help. Some of them are going to get resuscitated and brought back to life and be great companies. So anyway, I meandered there a little bit. Sorry.
Yeah, no, this is what this podcast is for. Did Mark Zuckerberg help people get some of this religion, or is he going to help revive some of these dead bodies just via what he wrote?
Absolutely. I wrote him an email about 14 months ago, and I called in a really big favor to ask him to get it to him. And I think it got to him. And I spent a lot of time on that email. I hope he read it. I'm not sure if he did. But that, and to some extent, some of the things that he's been doing, and others I believe have been, you know, pretty influential on him, of course. Getting fit, getting more competitive. Some of the things he's doing now would be, you know, exactly in line with some of the things I would have hoped he did when I sent him that email, you know, 13 or 14 months ago. There's other companies, Twitter, you know, and Twitter's cutting costs to pay down debt. Salesforce, and even one we like a lot, PayPal, you know, they're in the process of getting fit. I think it's a rational response after a buildup of excesses in 20 and 21. I mean, look, the gravity was turned off for a period of time, so everyone thought they could fly, and it's not the case anymore. So you're having a rational response to uncertainty in a period of excess that makes all the sense in the world. I feel like, what did you ask me? I probably meandered there a little bit.
No, whether or not Zuckerberg was going to help people get a little bit of religion on cost and whatnot through his.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it happened in post the .com correction, and it's happening again. You can't. At the end of the day, the management teams and especially the board, they're fiduciaries for the shareholders. And I still believe I'm kind of old fashioned in that sense. You know, very much believer in free markets and the capitalist system, you know, providing net benefits to all the participants, you know, in the system. You can't forget the shareholders. And I think over the past couple of years, especially in the Valley, you know, the employees kind of really got a really, really good deal. You know, ironically, I think when I look at PayPal, I think that company getting fit, getting its costs in line, focusing on core operations, they're going to make their core product better. And I can't tell you exactly how, but that's going to make for a better, more competitive organization over time. So that happening more and more, and Mark Zuckerberg kind of leading the charge there on big tech, that's an awesome thing. I told you I think my opinion is that the worst place to be starting now over 3, 4, 5, 10 years is going to be big cap non-tech names that are already have optimized their level of earnings. Like a perfect example, maybe like AutoZone. Now, I'm not saying AutoZone's the best short in the world, any of that, like I'm not saying that. But I think a company like that, given its current valuation, given its size, given how optimized it is already, will likely provide a much worse return than some smaller left for dead company that's been abandoned that you could buy right now for a fraction of its intrinsic value. I left out, what I was saying is I left out big tech from that. And part of the reason I left out big tech is because when big tech gets fit, I think big tech is going to have the ability to drive way more earnings growth than people think. I would probably leave Apple out of that, but you obviously think Google, you know, would be one. And I think that they have that card to play. And I think for a period of time, it was like, it was out of fashion to like really gun your earnings, so as not to draw the scrutiny of regulators or politicians that say how little in taxes you're paying and how, you know, how much you're earning. I think that's out of style. It's coming back into style. Get lean, get mean, earn a ton of money, reinvest in your core product, and make yourself even more competitive. And that's like a virtuous circle going, the self-reinforcing circle going the other way. I think that's a great trend. So even though big tech has had a big run over the past decade, I do think that that's a card that they still get to play.
One of the interesting comments that, and I'm going to mess it up because it's off memory, but Zuckerberg's letter was how he talked about when they removed bodies from the organization, how much quicker they were able, like how much layers or how many like layers of approval and whatnot, and how much faster they were able to move, and that it surprised him in that they were actually able to, it sounds to me, if I'm recalling correctly, that they're able to do more with less. And it makes sense, but reading it from him was kind of surprising for some reason. I think it's just the amount of people that they had hired. It's kind of nice to see him come to that conclusion, because I do feel as though it probably applies to a lot of different organizations.
Yeah, 100%. I think PayPal was one of the first ones, you know, and why did they do it? You know, they drew an activist. You know, I think there's other companies that still need to get fit. I mean, most of them need to get fit. I think the minority of companies that are really pushing hard, at least the larger ones, I guess you would kind of put Twitter, you know, again, to service debt, Salesforce, potentially, PayPal, Facebook, or Meta. It's still something that is yet to fully play out. And I would say the shareholders will get less and less satisfied for the companies that kind of are living in the past regime. And you don't want a bunch of angry shareholders. Even if you have two classes of shares and control the company, there's still a cost to, you know, your equity starts lagging. You know, you got to keep up with the stock-based compensation and grants of a Meta whose share price is now outperformed. So they even the ones that in theory could ignore their shareholders, they really can't. It comes to bite them in other ways if they're not paying attention. So I think that's a trend that probably will continue to happen for a period of time, if I had to guess.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to watch. You know, not to bring up something that hasn't gone too well, but, you know, I'm curious to hear what drew you to Uber, and, you know, your comments on dilution and whatnot. It's just a natural question. Like, what do you see there, and why have you stayed there? I know it's an incredible consumer product, but I've never been able to get my head around the financials and how the spending works. And I'm more asking this for my own education as opposed to anything else. Does getting lean and getting focused, does that help that business show what it can finally be?
Yeah, and my belief is that they haven't gotten fully fit. You know, they did respond to the pandemic with some cost cuts, and they needed to do that. But I think that company was born in a place that tends to, you know, produce companies that tend to be okay with excess. And it was born at a time of great excess. So it's like excess upon excess. And I don't think that has been fully vanquished from the organization as of yet. What my interest is, I think, for heaven's sake, they disrupted cabs, you know, globally. It's pretty amazing. Like, so the mobility marketplace is the real reason that we're there. And look, and like a couple other, in my career, I've made mistakes, but like more recently, in late 20 and 21, I was a little bit too immune from the valuation of certain companies. Stitch Fix was one, you know, and that was an error. And Uber was another one. You know, it really played out very nicely for us. We, you know, I think we first got involved when the shares were around $18 to $20, and it got up to as high as $60. And I was kind of determined to play for the long term, and that was a bit of a mistake. We have sold some shares, you know, since then at very good prices relative to the current price. But that mobility marketplace, I think, is a wonderful business, and they have, you know, absolutely tremendous scale that they've brought to bear upon solving this problem. So, you know, I basically, you know, I think the mobility business is it has classic marketplace attributes, and it is destined to be a growing free cash flow, massive free cash flow generator, a cash cow. I do think that they moved frustratingly slow towards, you know, kind of traditional profitability. And they should have their first operating profit, GAAP operating profit quarter, you know, sometime soon, which, look, that would tend to take, there was not long ago where people say this company will never be profitable. And then they break out, and they're kind of saying mobility is already profitable. Well, it's soon it won't be able to be debated whether or not this company could be operating on a GAAP, you know, profitably on a GAAP basis. I think that debate will be over. It still has a pretty good market cap, so like it does need to produce significant scale in its earnings. And I think one of the arguments I make to that team and to others from time to time is that, does Uber have scale? I mean, you know, and how do you measure that scale? I think undoubtedly Uber has scale. You might measure it in terms of revenue. You know, market cap arguably is a way to measure it, but that's transitory. Total OpEx is one way to do it. And so, like, if you say, let me take all companies in the U.S. with scale, you know, that aren't banks or not energy companies or whatnot, and let me see what kind of earnings quality they deliver to their shareholders. You know, we get a range of 60 to 70% of EBIT, GAAP EBIT over adjusted EBITDA. And my belief is that Uber owes its shareholders the high end of that range rather quickly here. And so to me, I think they've done a good job. And, you know, the CEO there also came in at a time when there was lots of scandals, lots of things going on. He stabilized the company. He gets a lot of credit for that. But I do think that I think they should be more aggressive in pulling forward their expectations, that they should be working much more diligently towards pulling those future earnings forward now and surprising the marketplace that way. And I think there are some strong arguments. Actually, I don't even think that's an argument. To me, it's a fact that they are, their quality of earnings, they're not on a trajectory to get to the same level of quality of earnings that other companies that have scale in, across all businesses have. And I don't think that's great. And I consider them an above average business. So if anything, I think that you should be doing better than other companies with scale. So we'll see. We'll see how that goes.
And when you're talking about quality of earnings, you're talking about are you referring to that as EBIT divided by adjusted EBITDA? Or are you defining that as free cash flow conversion? Like,
yeah, you could do it in a variety of different ways. The way I did it right there was GAAP EBIT,
yeah,
for adjusted EBITDA. You could also do like SBC over free cash flow, like what percent of free cash flow stock based comp. You know, there's a bunch of different ways to do it. I tend to like the EBIT over EBITDA because it's quite simple.
Yeah, interesting. So it's you're looking at a scaled business with a massive. I mean, it's a part of everyone's life, right? And a global platform, and then benchmarking it to where you think it should go. And that to me is the creativity piece that requires an insight, right? I haven't thought of it in that way, but I'm going to sit down and think about it in that way. So thank you for that.
I called it I think when I did another podcast, I called it the undeletable app. It still is the undeletable app. I think the shares are down since I said it, called it the undeletable app. So
well,
you can have an undeletable app and still lose money. So like that's that, but it's still an undeletable app. And what are they going to do from now going forward? What are they going to do from now going forward for us? I think that they're coming into a stride. They're coming into a point where their incremental bookings on top of their overhead is going to start converting at a very, very attractive rate. And, you know, the tide has gone out on cheap capital. So, you know, the gravity has been restored and people are no longer able to fly. And, you know, the companies that were able to take market share from them and give them a hard time because they raised really cheap equity capital, that's going to fade away. So their returns on invested capital and their incremental, their conversion from their bookings to revenue to EBIT and EBITDA, you know, on incremental bookings, I think are going to be all attractive. And it's really a nice setup. But I do I think this is a company that's fully fit? Do I think this is a company that should not be on a diet? No. I think they could do better for their shareholders. I really do. And that's not, I don't want to sound overly critical because I think they've done a great job running the business. And by the way, I got to say, this thing that they did with upfront fares and Trip Radar, that is going to make this business even harder for others to get to where they are. I really believe that. I think that's going to make it so difficult for others to follow.
Trip Radar is in, like, I can see where the car is that's coming to me, and the upfront fare is in, I can choose the fare that I'm going to pay, and I pay it, and then I don't have to worry. Is that what you mean?
Well, rather than, you know, exactly define what those things are, let's, you know, well, just from a driver's point of view, what they're doing is they're showing the drivers multiple rides at once.
Okay.
And they're showing the fare up front.
Interesting.
And to do that at scale is really, really fascinating. And there's a lot of detail in there that probably isn't worth getting into. But let's say the rideshare 1.0 was kind of stuck in a time and metered mindset. Passenger wants to go from point A to point B. Who's around there? We come up with the fare. We come up with, you know, what we're going to charge for the ride, and we ping the drivers one by one and see who eventually, you know, is attracted by that price and takes it. Now they're basically saying, okay, let's show, you know, we've got four or five different, you know, passengers here. We got four or five different drivers here. Let's show all of them, all the drivers, kind of what's available. And let's, you know, not everyone's going to get to see the same fare. Someone might be closer. Someone might be a more experienced driver. There's different costs. So essentially, they're getting out of that ping one driver using a time and miles kind of mindset to ping multiple drivers at once. And let's find out the fare really motivates that driver. That was not easy to do. You can't do it in every place. You can't do it in New York City. But there's plenty of places you can do it. And they rolled it out in the U.S. and they're rolling it out globally. I think that is going to be the death knell for rideshare 1.0. It's going to be very, very difficult for others to attain that. You have to have immense scale in addition to all the time and energy it takes to kind of program that. That's kind of like the nerd geek in me talking about Uber. But I think they just made the barriers to scale in this business harder on everybody.
Yeah, I think that nerd geek stuff is super interesting.
Yeah, me too.
One of the things that I'm so fascinated to see in the next 5 years is, yeah, we were in a bubble for sure, but there are a lot of people, and a younger me would have said for certain that, you know, a lot of these businesses don't make any money and this is all crazy. And the older me thinks that this conversation needs to be a lot more nuanced. And I'm really excited to see what a lot of these businesses are in 5 years. So when we look back at where the valuations were, how crazy does it actually look 5 years out? Because I think that there's more than a couple grains of truth to a lot of these businesses. And I think that a lot of the businesses that use the cheap capital years to really grow and become household names may have an opportunity to flex that scale. And that'd be interesting to see.
Some of them are going to go on and be great companies. I mean, I can't say I'm an expert on it, but I'll just mention one, like Xometry is a public company orphan. It's been absolutely murdered in the public marketplace. And it's a marketplace for machine goods and shopped orders or non-skewable orders. And it's, you know, they basically put a buy now Amazon kind of button, you know, where one didn't exist in this industry before. And they don't own any of these shops, but they kind of, you know, they corral the demand and then, you know, and then they quote the price, you know, and you can buy now and get it. And then they kind of go find it. Essentially the price, they go buy the item later and they make a spread. It's fascinating. I'm not an expert on it. And maybe, you know, maybe the thing won't work out, but there's just so many. I just started looking at that, you know, recently, and so many names like that that have been beat up. That, you know, that's another kind of marketplace that has, you know, classic traits that, you know, that, you know, might lead to like a really good return one day, a really nice business. But there's so many of them. And, you know, the other, when you said that, it just reminded me, like, people, you know, nothing's static. Like, you know, here the world's changed. So equity cost of capital's changed. There's no capital available. Oh, guess what? Everyone cuts costs. Everyone gets leaner and meaner, tries to get more competitive. Necessity is the mother of invention. So these companies adjust. They don't just, like, you know, they're not going to lose money at the same rate. They're going to make adjustments. And, like, some of those adjustments are going to make the company more competitive and better. There's always adjustments. So, like, some of these companies are going to get better because of all this nonsense and this absolute mess of a time that we're having. Netflix got better because capital became more scarce at a period of time after the IPO. You know, there's reactions all over the place. You can't kind of bring a static playbook to these companies and assume that, you know, that their low share price is having absolutely no impact on how they view their business or how they do things. They do, and they get more competitive and they respond in kind. So,
yeah, well, and I think conversely, when you have high share prices that are rewarding growth, it would be foolish to think that management teams aren't going to pursue the growth that the market is rewarding them for. So the question really becomes, okay, well, what did they build here? And I think that's going to be really fascinating to watch. And the only business that I wish, well, I don't really care that it didn't come public, but they missed an opportunity. Bring a Trailer would have been an interesting one to see come public in 2020 or 2021. I think they would have gotten a huge, yeah, Bring a Trailer. It's a car purchasing website, but it's very impressive. Car guys love it. So we'll see. I think it's going to go public eventually, but maybe they just want to own it forever. Maybe it's the in and out of car marketplaces.
Oh, okay. Sounds interesting. I'll keep an eye out. Yeah. I don't
check it out. Bringatrailer.com. My dad loves it. He's always writing me about it. So what do you mean when you say your normal is someone else's nightmare?
I'm not sure. It might be a little bit hard to explain. I'll try to do it justice. It triggered me a bit when on Twitter, where everyone's like, there's the growth guys are getting their comeuppance. You know, now it's value's out. It's sort of like growth investors, and I'm trying to be growth and value, but I'm probably a little bit more in my mind, think a little bit more like a growth investor than a value guy. But, you know, the growth investors forgot that the Fed turned off the gravity in 2020 and they thought they could fly, and they forgot about value, and maybe they even, you know, dunked on value, and that was wrong. You know, then the value investors come roaring back, and they thought everything that happened from 2020 to2020 to 21, kind of the, you know, the zero interest rate, all that kind of stuff where everything took off, that was pure distortion, nothing else. We're back to normalcy now. They forget that a growing earnings stream is a valuable thing, you know, and that innovation can radically change the direction of things like that. That happens still. So, you know, I guess that's, you know, investors tend to view as normal the environment that they're most comfortable in and where they have the most opportunity to prosper. So I guess I'm saying that says there's not a singular normal that exists. Your normal as an investor is someone else's nightmare. And growth investors certainly went through a nightmare from summer 21 to summer 22 and 22, the rest of 22. And, you know, energy investors went through a nightmare for a long period of time. Small cap investors are. It's sort of like there's no new normal. Hopefully I did that little explanation justice.
Yeah.
I think said
somewhat differently. Maybe people, when they think that they're generating a lot of alpha, it's factor exposure, and people that are exposed to the other factor that's not doing well, like to kick sand in their face. And I don't know. One of the things that I try to do with this podcast, in part because I'm really trying to educate myself as much as the audience, but is to talk to a lot of different people, because I just think there's a lot of merit out there. The market in general is very, very smart. There's a lot of very, very smart ideas. I tend to be like you. I mean, I, you know, I understand why value works. I can fully articulate why deep value gets so hated that it's thrown out, and it's as a factor statistically too cheap too often. On average, I think a computer probably does that better than I would do. I think in part because you're sort of saying like people overreact to negative situations, and I don't know why I think I'd be better at judging a negative situation. So I'm trying to look for a specific situation that I understand, but you know, the small cap idea, the seed that you planted in my head has been an interesting one to have germinate, and it continues to. So thank you for that one, because I think it's an interesting place to play. I've talked to somebody who I won't name, but he told me that I should focus on like 800 million to call it 5 billion or something like that. He said that's like an area of the market where management teams are professionalized enough that you don't have to worry about like key man risk or something. You always have to worry about bad incentives, but he thinks it's a little bit more institutional quality business as opposed to some of the microcaps. But microcaps have been decimated. But to your point, I don't know how you play a microcap thesis unless you're going to pick them, right? Because I don't think there's a really good index way to play that.
I think I'm not sure if I mentioned one of my favorite ways to play the whole small cap resurgence, the small cap rip. That's absolutely coming. I don't know when it's coming. I don't know how much pain will be in between now and then, but it's coming. There's going to be a year when these things absolutely rip. You know, is my old boss's firm, Gamco Investors, Mario Gabelli. And that thing's a microcap. That thing has a low float, and you know, maybe it's got 800 million market cap, but a bunch of cash. So the enterprise value is kind of lower than the market cap, you know, and then, you know, not all of it trades. But I look at that thing and the earnings power in that thing when this market turns, is I think it's going to be, you know, absolutely amazing. So I don't know. There used to be more publicly traded small cap managers. There's not a lot of them now. I think a third of Mario's portfolio falls in, about a third probably falls under small cap. And you kind of think of like the lift, the wave that's coming towards small cap valuations at one point, lifting the long tail of that portfolio and getting that management fee, you know, on assets that are going to be well bid for. It kind of feels like a world away right now, but man, I could just taste it. That's coming. So I don't know. It's kind of funny after all these years, one of my favorite small cap plays is Mario Gabelli's publicly traded company.
Well, I think that's a good reason to keep following things, right? I would like to see it. I told you the one thing that I worry about that with is key man risk. But that's a pretty institutionalized group.
I told you, you don't have to worry about that. Vince McMahon's going to live forever, as is Mario Gabelli. No problem.
I like it. Well, I'll tell you what, he's got more energy than I ever have. I mean, listening to him pitch a stock is something that's wild. He's got this many shares out. It trades at this price, this and this and this. He knows it.
Good at shares outstanding. I'm good at where companies are located. My kids are like, I'm like, name a company. I'll tell you where it's headquartered. Like, how do you do that? He does his shares outstanding and the headquarters, everything. He does it all. But whatever, he was on CNBC the other day. I'm like, all right, let me watch this. Let me hear 20 minutes of Mario picking stocks. They're all good picks. They're all kind of like beat up things, good names, all sorts of different stuff. So, you know, and look, he's you don't know how the fund flows are going. You know, he is getting a little bit older, and you know, there's some key man risk there for sure. But the valuation on that thing is. Oh, like it's 4x EBIT or something like that. You know,
that's pretty cheap. Pretty cheap for a pretty good business.
It's undemanding and it spits off cash. The thing, you know, and he's got a huge chunk in closed-end funds that are not redeemable. And you know, you could say, hey, oh, he won't treat you fairly, this or that. You know, my baseline assumption is he's going to treat his shareholders fairly. You know, hopefully he will. But the real rip when Smalls rip. You know, that, you know, the earnings power of that company could be up a lot. And, you know, could the company go back in, you know, from getting some slight redemptions to actually zero and then to positive inflows with the appreciation? I mean, it's possible that company's earnings power over a really relatively short period of time could double or more. And that's kind of interesting. Again, that's a 1% position. I haven't made a big chunky bet on that. There's other things we're more comfortable making chunkier bets on, like at the top of our portfolio is Beckley, PayPal, you know, WWE, new combination there, Vita Coco, Carter's, Uber, things like that, you know, but there's so many cheap names out there. You know, we have broadened our portfolio. We have more names than we usually do, and we have more smaller positions than we usually do, just because, you know, the valuations are such that makes some sense. If you could 10% positions, if you could have 25% positions and you could cover them all and you're not really giving up any upside or, you know, anything by doing that, that's obviously a better situation to be a bit more diversified if you can swing it.
Yeah, that makes sense. So would you say that in an environment where you, like, I mean, in today's environment, you're going to be more diversified than you would in, say, 2021's environment when the pickings are few and far between?
Yeah, absolutely. Though I've warned our investors, it's the kind of a market where in the drop of a hat, you find the perfect thing. You know, you get it right back on in a second. So we would reconstitute the portfolio very quickly, you know, for something that kind of made sense to do. And it's the kind of environment where that could happen, you know, very quickly. So we have to be, you know, we're agile and we're ready to move and move quickly if the opportunity presents itself. There's more, you know, I know it's been an abused term on Twitter, but like 10 baggers, you know, compounder bros looking for 10 baggers. Well, guess what? Like, there's way more compounders out there right now. There's way more 10 baggers out there right now. They've been absolutely decimated in this marketplace. So they were, when everyone was looking for them because it was the cool thing to do in 2020, there were fewer of them. Guess what? No one's looking. Oh, no, I shouldn't say no one. A lot less people are looking for them right now. So there's a lot more of them by definition. They're out there. You know, maybe it's Xometry, maybe it's something else. One of the orphan names we bought, we like a lot, is Remitly, a digital remittance provider in Seattle. That, you know, that's probably doubled for us over some recent period. You know, that is a long way to go to get back to its IPO price, but growing like an absolute weed. These things are all over the place. So it's an exciting time. I mean, it is. I'm not joking when I'm saying this is as interesting of a period as it's been for me to look for value, look for names, look for good investment opportunities since the early 2000s. I 100% believe that. I think, I mean, maybe I'm sounding too arrogant. I think I know how this movie plays out. I just do. It's like, I've seen it, you know, I've seen it. Well, it'll rhyme. It may not play out exactly the same way, but I'm convinced of it, that smalls and mids are really going to outperform. The large safe stings are going to have a much harder time. And eventually the flows are going to come this way and the whole cycle will repeat itself. I mean, you know, it wasn't too long ago. I mean, what was it? What year was it? 2013 or so? I mean, we bought Apple. Apple X Cash was like 7 or 8 times earnings. We made like 70% on it. Foolish me for selling it. But like, you know, the idea that these big safe companies, like, hey, they'll never see single digit PEs again or low double digit PEs like all these small companies will, like Carter's. Well, like, that'll never happen. Like, bullshit. That's happening sometime in the next 10 years. It's going to happen.
As long as the ROIC stays where it is and the growth is what people perceive it to be, then it probably won't happen. But the probability of that happening is, I think, lower than the stock prices on average would imply. Right.
I didn't quite follow what you just said.
Well, it's like, you know, I mean, look, I do think like higher return on capital businesses do justify higher PEs, right? But I think that thought is taken too far, because if you can't reinvest in the growth at your returns, then sort of the delta that you should be worth is how much you can distribute to cash, like to shareholders in a steady state, right? But that's not, I don't think that that's, those businesses aren't priced for steady state. They're priced for growth. I mean, a lot of these high quality stuff, they're trading at like 3.5 times free cash flow. I mean, you got to grow if that's where you're priced.
Yeah, no, I think I got you. I'll make one parallel that maybe some people, a lot of people wouldn't agree with. In the last indexing bubble, big cap bubble in the late 90s, early 2000s, the overvaluation was obvious and overt. Home Depot was like 80 times earnings, Walmart 60 times earnings, Merck, GE, all these big companies got massive valuations. Oh, and that's easy. That's easy to see that was a bubble, and then you had this period where small caps really ripped relative to the S&P. And like you could have shorted Walmart in 1999, in early 2000, and not have lost money for, I think, over a decade. A lot of these things kind of went side down first and then clawed their way back and didn't get up to their prior peak for a very long period of time. Okay. That was obvious and overt, that overvaluation. What I think on the big cap side now, what's less obvious, they're not sitting out there with insane PEs. Like the top 50 biggest company in the S&P 500 are probably, and I did this, it was like 20, 21 times earnings. And that was kind of like in January, February, assuming that hasn't changed too much. To me, though, what's changed is that the absolute size of these companies, they're just massive now. So you could do this exercise, which I did in the late 90s, which is to take one of those companies and say, oh, the investors are expecting, I don't know, 8 to 10% return from holding this investment over the next 10 years. And you take that market cap up to what that is. You have to dilute for options and whatnot. So there's some stock-based compensation in there. And you get, because you're starting with such big numbers, 10 years later, you get a massive, massive market cap that has to exist for this company to deliver, that kind of return for investors. Essentially, I think some of those numbers are close to impossible or very, very difficult to achieve. Meaning for AutoZone to compound value for its investors at, at 9% for the next 10 years, it has to eat a lot of other people's lunches, a lot, or expand internationally and do everything and everything perfect to get to like this big market cap. And then what's the valuation going to be at that point? You clearly would have to be like, well, the market is not, probably not going to put 20 times on it or 18 times on it, wherever it's currently trading. It's probably going to put something less on it. So if you put a lower multiple on that, then it's like that's even more pressure to get to that, to get the that assumed IRR. Meaning the company's going to have to earn even more because there's going to be some compression in valuation. So to me, and some smart person that watches it podcast, you have smart people that watch your podcast,
I
right?
think a few. I think at least two.
Smart, just two or three. Some really smart person is going to tell me, the analysis I just did kind of in my head, how it's kind of wrong. I think I'd like to hear how it is. But I think that is the problem with some of these big caps now. Too many things have to go right for them to get to provide a somewhat reasonable market plus kind of return over a longer period of time. And just, I think the laws of gravity, and notice I didn't say the law of large numbers, I know exactly what that is. Just gravity and competitive, the competitive nature of things will make that really hard to happen for some of these big companies that are highly optimized currently for earnings.
Yeah, I think one of the things that, and I don't know this well enough to, but I'm going to say it because it's a podcast and whatever. AutoZone, the thing that's tough is a lot of that historical return has been through very accretive share repurchases, and at these valuations, the kind of cat may be out of the bag on how good they are at doing share repurchases, and that may be reflected in the price. And if that is the case, then future share repurchases will not be as accretive, and therefore not as fruitful for future returns, but
Yeah, that's right. They can do dividends instead, but essentially I'm compounding current earnings that are certainly not lacking. It's not like they're coming off a poor earnings cycle or anything like that. They're really optimized nicely. I'm compounding them forward for a bunch of years. I did that in the late 90s with Yahoo, and I guess if I was a better investor, or I don't know, more of a I tend to do what I'm good at and stick with that. But I remember I did the same thing with Yahoo when I came out to impossible numbers, and I just had the realization. I'm like, this is impossible. This cannot happen. They're not going to be bigger than every other media company kind of globally. And that it was like some insane number like that. And when I play with numbers like that again on some of these big things, I get to situations that I'm just like, realistically, like that's it's improbable that this will happen. And of course, it's just the nature of things. Like GE was the most powerful company ever, right? The odds of those that are on top now being on top 10 years from now, they're not high. And I can't tell you exactly how so and so Apple's lunch is going to be eaten, or Google, or maybe, yeah, Google's easy, AI, right? That they're dead. Sorry. That's exactly how that's going to happen. But it's, those numbers kind of don't work. And so that I think will act as gravity and pull towards a lot of these small things. And even though private equity has essentially picked over every single last good one of them, so there's nothing left.
Well, if valuations get high enough, private equity will float them back to the public markets, right? And then the cycle can continue. I don't know. For now, they're just trading them in between funds, from what I hear. But what do I know? What didn't you ping me a while ago about down rounds being avoided? What was going on?
I think, a lot of, well, that would be less for private equity. That would be more for startups, that they essentially are putting value on new rounds, not having an effect on prior valuations. So they're term heavy and designed to not create a write down on prior rounds, which is
What's
a
term heavy? What do you mean?
They're new securities, whatever. Lawyers would be better at this than me, but they create new securities and whatever terminology that they have to use in their agreements to avoid the new mark on the equity, they do that.
Okay. Interesting. Well, it's a nice game to be able to mark to model. Unfortunately, public investors don't have that luxury, right?
Yeah, that was current in about January, February. Things move fast, so maybe things have changed a bit, but that was current January, February kind of
Yeah.
thinking.
I suspect it hasn't moved that fast, but I don't know what I'm talking about. But anyway, we'll see. Well, I appreciate you doing this. We've talked about it for a while, and one of the joys of the podcast is getting to know people like yourself, and I've really enjoyed getting to know you, so thank you. And it's been a fun conversation, man. I hope it's been good for you.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Hopefully I didn't put everyone to sleep.
How can a man that holds his shoe up put anyone to sleep?
And that was impromptu. I didn't plan that. That was impromptu. I think I've done some podcasts where they've been a little bit boring, so I'm like, I'm not going to have this one be boring.
Holding my shoe up on this one.
So
Well,
sorry.
next time we can drink some Jose Cuervo and juice the share price there. I got a
Yeah.
buddy that's starting a tequila company called Costa, and tequila's flying around here. I don't know if it's because I'm in Florida, or I don't know if it's because the same thing that's happening in beer is happening in tequila. But boy, the volumes seem to be exploding.
Yeah, it's hard to, trends in spirits tend to play for a long time. Like, so it's hard for vodka. Well, vodka was nothing and it became a massive drink. It's hard for vodka to push back against tequila gaining share. It tends to kind of play and play and play and go over, multi-year period. So tequila is very much in the driver's seat, probably destined to become the number two spirit, in the US sometime here in the next few years. And
This is
our
going to
big,
sound really ignorant, but behind what? Bourbon or vodka?
I think, is it
Or neither?
vodka's number one, and then I think whiskey's number two.
Yeah.
And
Okay, that makes sense.
I could have had that reversed. Please, someone will know better than me. But it's riding a massive wave of popularity and demand in the US.
Demographics are on its side too.
Yeah, 100%. And the little trick play there, the way we have it, so it trades a discount, and we'll end it on this, but it trades a discount to peers. Spirits businesses are great businesses. Unlike financial institutions, they don't go to zero every 10 years or have the possibility of doing that. So eliminating the possibility of a zero does wonders for your multiple. I guess Warren Buffett figured that out. That was a recent revelation. I'm like, oh, Warren Buffett figured that out probably 25 years ago. I just figured it out again.
Yeah,
We've
he's a
always been.
smart cat. That said, he owned a lot of financials for a long time.
He's not too bad. He knows a couple things, but we tend to be light on financials. But anyway, that Becle is the biggest global producer of tequila, and there was this epic agave spike. Agave is what creates tequila, and agave spiked from like 5 pesos per kilo to 30, and like you might expect when a crop gets, you know, turns into gold, and all your neighbors and all your fellow farmers want to plant it, and that's happening. There's an epic wave of agave supply coming while tequila's been taking price, and there's been more demand in tequila than we would have forecast 3 or 4 years ago when we first bought Becle shares. So agave hasn't come crashing down, but it is going to, almost for sure. And so this company is going to have a very lush margin for an extended period of time at one point, and there's plenty of demand for the product. And the real home run is like, does it take off globally? Like, does it work globally? And tequila is starting to work globally. So it's a unique kind of orphaned assets trading on the Mexican bourse. That's essentially a US dollar play, trades in Mexico, you know, for whatever reason, that's the way they chose to do it. That's our top position. We love that one. And anyone ever want to ping me on it and say, talk about it a bit, I'm always willing to.
All right, cool. Well, you heard them, folks. If you can add value, ping them, and you can find them on Twitter. And where else can they find you?
Right by Grand Central in New York City.
just don't stalk the man. Don't be weird.
Yeah, I won't give my exact address.
All right. Well, thanks again for stopping by, and it's been a pleasure, man.
Yeah, thank you.